The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As Super Tuesday results rolled in last night, something interesting was happening online. After 8 p.m. Eastern Time, when it was clear that Donald Trump would likely take 7 of the contested states, the search term "Move to Canada" spiked on Google. Google's data editor Simon Rogers noted on Twitter that they'd gone up 350% in 4 hours. Among the top related searches, "Move to Canada if Trump wins." While threatening to flee the country when your candidate loses is nothing new. Similar claims were made after Barack Obama was elected in 2008, but not on this scale. Some travel destinations are even using the line, "You can come here if Trump wins," in their advertising. When Donald Trump's support started gaining in the fall, the digital analytics firm Luminoso analyzed 4.5 Trump-related tweets to find out where people thought they'd go. Denise Christie is Client Insights Consultant at Luminoso, which initiated the Trump Tracker. Denise, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
So out of those 4.5 million tweets you looked at, how many were from people claiming they would leave the country if Trump were elected?
It was actually quite a high percentage of people. The overall total, just in general, was 69,000 people of those 4.5 million flat out said that they were moving just in general, didn't specify a total. But an additional 75,000 said that they would move to Mexico, and 25,000 more said that they would move specifically to Canada. So all in all, the grand total was approximately 100,000 people of those 4.5 million tweets explicitly saying that they were going to move out of the country if Trump was elected.
So 75,000 to Mexico, 25,000 to Canada. I don't know if you've heard this, but there is the town of Cape Breton that is now using this as part of its pitch campaign. If Trump wins, you can move to Cape Breton.
Yes, we've definitely seen that in the data as well as we've continued to collect some of this data. We have also seen people specifically talking about Cape Breton and seriously planning or at least looking into moving there if Trump is elected.
Are Twitter users saying the same thing about other candidates? You know, the "I'll move if Hillary Clinton wins," for example?
Not to the same extent, interestingly enough. There are definitely people who, you know, share their opinions quite honestly about Hillary Clinton, but we really haven't seen much in the way of threatening to leave the country in the same way. It tends to be, you know, other vague threats around, you know, taking advantage of the Second Amendment, those types of things, but not threatening to up and leave entirely.
Wow, that's intense. Where are some of the other destinations that people talked about moving to if Trump were to win?
It usually tends to be holiday type of holiday destinations, lots of places in Europe. So England, France, Spain, some Caribbean countries as well. So Jamaica. Some South American locations, such as Brazil. And there are the handful of people who, I can't quite tell if they're joking or speaking in earnest, but who will definitely move to either Alaska or Hawaii, they say.
Well, so I guess not quite out of the union.
Now, not quite out of the union. But
now, you conducted this research in the fall when a lot of people were still dismissing Trump and said, oh, forget it, he won't last. Now, plunging ahead, any sense of the numbers now?
Yeah, it has been interesting to see the difference. And as you stated, back this in August when we were collecting the data, a lot of the conversation on Twitter was a lot more joking. People weren't quite taking it seriously still. Now, there are still the comments about people willing to move if Trump is elected, and it's still in the same rough proportions. A lot of people saying that they'll either move to or move back to Mexico. Many more people talking about moving to Canada, especially with everything going on with Cape Breton. But in general, the conversation that we've been seeing come in has become a lot more serious. Fewer people joking about, you know, moving and more people either, especially, you know, given Super Tuesday and all the primaries coming up, really earnestly speaking out either in support or in opposition to Trump.
Twitter was around for the 2012 election and even before that, but the penetration wasn't quite as deep. How much of an influence do you think those conversations are actually having on how we think about the candidates and politics?
It definitely is having more of an influence where people are, you know, not only is a larger base of people using Twitter. Back in 2012, the user base for Twitter really was, in general, much younger, whereas now Twitter has a larger, more demographically diverse base of users. The conversation also has expanded quite a bit because back 4 years ago, again, it was a younger demographic base and generally swung more liberal, whereas since the 2012 elections, the Republican Party has really taken advantage of Twitter, and there's a very vibrant and very active conservative bent on Twitter now, and conservative groups where they're using hashtags to connect to other conservatives on Twitter. And so now, in this election season, we've seen a broader range of conversations, a broader range of opinions, and also people retweeting and sharing their opinions more. So much more of the dialogue and self is happening on Twitter than it was in 2012. And I do think now that a lot of the politicians who are running are paying much closer attention to what's happening on social media than they did in 2012. 2012, it was people were just sort of learning about it. It was a really revolutionary way of keeping tabs on what the populace was saying. And now it's really built in more to their strategy. Politicians are actively on Twitter and have very active pages and are retweeting and responding to people who are reaching out to them in that venue.
Denise Christie, client insights consultant at Luminoso, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Luminoso conducted the analysis for the Trump Tracker, and we've got a link to that research at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd like to know, have you ever considered leaving the country because of an election? Well, where would you go? Let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the early and mid-20th century, hotels, airlines, and travel agencies used full-color travel posters to inspire customers to dream about that once-in-a-lifetime vacation, to finally book that trip to an exotic locale. Now, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory has resurrected the old-school travel poster. JPL recently launched a new series of dazzling space travel posters that harken back to the golden age of airline travel to encourage people to imagine a future where touring the historic sites of Mars or visiting more than 100 breathtaking geysers on the tiny Saturnian moon Enceladus could be on your short list for spring break. Don and Ryan Clark are the brothers behind Invisible Creature. It's a design and illustration studio based in Seattle that designed three of the posters for JPL's Vision of the Future series. And Don Clark is with us now to talk about the project. Don, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So how did you get this gig first with JPL to design the posters?
Yeah, that seems to be the golden question. Actually, it came from a friend of mine who is a visual strategist at NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California. Both of us have music backgrounds. We were both in bands and toured kind of back in the day, like, you know, 15 years ago. And we've just kind of kept in touch over the years. And he asked if we wanted to work on this, a few posters in this series. So it was just kind of a no-brainer. We jumped at it.
Well, of course, anybody would, but lest anyone thinks it's nepotism, you have a very well-established career and studio at Invisible Creature. And also a little bit of this runs in the family. I guess your grandfather, Alfred Paulsen, actually did work for NASA as well. What did he do?
He was a graphic designer and illustrator, much more of an illustrator, I would say. But yeah, for over 30 years, he worked at Ames Research Center at Moffett Field. And it's funny, when I got the call from Joby at JPL about the project, and I was like, gosh, you know, did you have any, you know, did I ever tell you about my grandfather and his history and our family's history? And he's like, no. So it was interesting. No one knew about this. And so when it came kind of full circle and we were working on something for NASA, the family obviously just kind of freaked out, and it was a lot of fun.
Quite something. So what kind of direction did you get? I mean, visions of the future are pretty wide open compared to the mid-century. When I went back and looked at some of those old NASA posters, you know, people are wearing regular suits and ties, you know, riding what looks like the monorail. It was a very contained vision. So what did they tell you?
Yeah, the idea is that these posters would be inspired by, you know, vintage mid-century or WPA style posters. But the big concept was, what would they look like 500 years from now? So specifically with Mars, if you were to go visit the historic sites of Mars, what would those be? You'd go see where the rovers, where they've been, maybe where we first found water, agriculture, populating the planet, architecture. So that's kind of the idea is, yes, we're inspired by that era of work, but we're fast forwarding hundreds of years in the future.
You got to make something that really lasts if you're talking about 500 years.
Exactly. And, we throw around the word timeless a lot, but that's really an important thing for us is we don't always, you know, hit a home run with our projects, but we do always hope that our work is something that doesn't feel like now or 5 years ago. And, you know, we really want we do want it to last.
Well, you've got three posters, as you mentioned in the series, one called The Grand Tour, Enceladus, and Mars. So what does The Grand Tour commemorate?
It was part of the, actually ended up being part of the Voyager mission, but every 175 years, they found out that the alignment of Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus and Neptune were all in one. They were aligned, so you could technically go see all four of those on one mission. The Voyager mission, I believe, just ended up being Jupiter and Saturn, if I'm not mistaken. That's the idea there, is that, you know, in the future, every 175 years, you could take your personal ship or maybe take a tour ship and go visit these planets. And so that's the idea.
Well, that poster is just full of motion. You see these planets kind of in alignment and all these various different spacecraft ships whizzing by and the lines following them. But the image for Enceladus is much more, I guess, peaceful. What is it that you were doing with that poster?
I think the idea here is that, you know, we wanted to show these strong icy geysers that are shooting out of the moon. And that was something that NASA wanted to see. But the idea is that you can visit that in the future. And so we kind of came up with this idea that this is like a solo ship that maybe this man had designed and, you know, years before. And so this maybe is his final run to go visit Enceladus. So it's funny, we actually took the dog out at one point, and then NASA wanted, you know, to see him back in there. So yeah, that was a fun one.
The other thing about this is these are available by download in high resolution for free. So you're basically creating these posters to give away. Is this something you've done before?
You know, it's not. This is our first public domain project. We were hired by NASA to work on these, but they are available for free to download from their website. We did three of them. They have also allowed us to sell our own limited prints that are signed by us. So we have those available as well. But they can be yours for free.
You mentioned before that this was right in your wheelhouse, sort of this mid-century design, this kind of old school travel poster, as well as portraying the future. But I'm thinking, you know, 50s, 60s, these were the golden years of the space program when people were thinking about space. It was a part of their thinking and a kind of goal. Are you trying to recapture or reignite that feeling?
I think so. I think with everything that we do, that there's that little lightning in a bottle that we're trying to capture. And when you look at something from that era, I think your mind instantly takes you back. And even if it's subconscious, you can't articulate it, you instantly know that it's optimistic. It was a time when, you know, cars were looking like spaceships, and anything was possible. So that is the era that I love so much because it is so optimistic. It was such a fertile time for amazing design, whether it was architecture, illustration, graphic design, music. The arts were so great in that era. And that era for me spans about 50 years, you know, you could say from even the 20s to the 70s. So that really is our world.
Don, thank you for speaking with us.
Oh, I appreciate it. It's been fun.
Don Clark, he's co-founder, along with his brother Ryan, of Invisible Creature. That's a design and illustration studio, and they're based in Seattle. They designed 3 of the 14 posters for JPL's Visions of the Future series. Now, we do have a link so you can see and download all of the posters. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare.
Mars may not be a vacation destination anytime soon, but a serious study of vacations can actually tell us a lot about the history of privilege and social class in the United States. This next piece comes to us from our series, The Uncommon Core, which examines unusual college classes and was produced by Taylor Quimby.
Hi, my name is Susan Burrell. I teach in the American Studies and Women's Studies programs at the University of Iowa, and I teach a course on the American vacation. Vacations were an important part of the social life of the upper class in the United States throughout the 19th century. They even had a circuit of vacations that followed the sun in some ways. And it's not until the turn of the 20th century that the middle class begins to see vacations as something that's possible for them.
The presidential yacht Williamsburg stands by in the Potomac to take aboard the chief executive for his first extended vacation since taking over the job 16 months ago.
One of the things that had to get resolved was how to justify, what rationales to use for this newly emerging, hard-working middle class to make it seem logical for them to take time away from work, which was seen as the centerpiece of their lives.
The last Civil War veteran would die in 1959, and no longer would there be living memories of long ago battles, only history and legends.
Historic tourism, for example, going to visit the battlefields of the Civil War, going to a historic site was thought of as a worthy use of leisure time. Or later on, when the national parks became available, going out west celebrated the wild beauty of the United States. And consolidated notions of our pride in the U.S.
Every summer, thousands of pleasure-seeking tourists head for the great outdoor playgrounds of America.
Every day, it's the same old thing. Look at the bears, look at the bears, look at the bears. Sheesh.
But probably the biggest rationale was the notion that the vacation was something that families would do together. Particularly white middle-class families found the vacation a really central part of family life.
Are we there yet?
No!
Are we there yet?
No!
Are we there yet?
No!
We talk about the cottages of Newport, Rhode Island. We talk about the growth of the Adirondacks as a place where rusticators could have their vacations. We work our way through the 20th century, usually ending in Disneyland, which is the most common experience for everybody in the class. At the end of the semester, they've done 3 interviews with themselves, their parents, their grandparents, and they write a vacation history, which is a joy for me to read.
Well, I'll tell you something. This is no longer a vacation. It's a quest. It's a quest for fun.
Inevitably, what happens at the end of the semester is that students have learned what a privilege it is to be part of a rich vacation history. It's likely that their grandparents might say, "We never took a vacation when I was a kid." But in fact, what they find then is that, well, they went to the state fair every year.
Our state fair is a great state fair. Don't miss it, don't even be late.
One of the experiences that I can draw on is my own family experience of vacations. And we took a number of family vacations to historic sites. And the grand finale was the trip that we took out west to see the national parks. Of course, we took it in a car, with all that entailed in the years before superhighways. Well, if you ever plan to motor west. So now when I look back on that trip, I can see it as a piece of history. I can see what inspired the trip for my family. I can see the experiences in a new light. And I'm hoping that that's the way that students look at their own vacations. Well, it winds from Chicago to L.A. More than 2,000 miles all the way. Get your kicks on Route 66.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is March, the month of madness for fans of college basketball. Also a big month for Luke Bonner, who played Division I ball and is now an advocate for college players. Luke grew up in Concord shooting hoops with his tall, athletic brother Matt, sister Becky, and his dad, Dave Bonner, a mail carrier. His mother Paula was a teacher and 6'2". Their parents pushed academics over sports, but drove thousands of miles and spent countless dollars to support the kids' dreams of getting an athletic scholarship to a good school. Now Matt plays for an NBA team, the San Antonio Spurs. Becky is an NBA rep who conducts basketball clinics in the U.S. and abroad. Luke now works in sports marketing and is co-founder of the College Athletes Players Association, one of the organizations challenging powerful and lucrative college athletics to expand the rights of players. Luke wrote about the hard work and punishing expectations on NCAA athletes for vice. It is an issue we hear a lot about, but rare that we get to hear it from someone who's been through it, especially someone local. And with that, Luke Bonner, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So you went to a prestigious university on an athletic scholarship, right? That's something that people dream of, yet you found the reality quite different. How?
Well, certainly it was, you know, in a sense, a dream come true. But I kind of bring a broader perspective. Out of high school in New Hampshire, I went and played Big East basketball at West Virginia University. And I ended up transferring, you know, back to New England and finished up at UMass. My brother played high-level Division I ball at Florida, and my sister also played high-level basketball at Stanford and Boston University. So just leading up to that, I kind of saw what they went through. And, you know, when you're growing up and you want to play, you know, big time college basketball, what you see is these sold out arenas, you know, the guys on TV, you get a so-called free ride, which is a total myth. And the reality is, you know, when you're there, you're putting in 40 hours a week on top of your academic schedule. I'm doing a lot of work. I had no idea, like, my insurance, if I got hurt on the court, that's my parents' insurance covering that stuff. There's a lot of really basic, you know, things that you would think would be covered in this multi-billion dollar industry for the players, but there's really, you know, not much for them.
Well, this isn't the first time that we've heard that students are kind of at the mercy of the NCAA or other non-professional organizations of sport. So how are some of the ways that you've actually seen that play out?
So as a player, you're subjected to, you know, a 300 plus page NCAA rule book that, as you know, the player, you have literally zero say in what these policies are, and they dominate your life. So, you know, an example of that, my brother was a, you know, All-American high school player, and he went on one of his five full expenses paid official visits. And we went out to the Outback Steakhouse, and he's a big guy, 6'9", you know, 240 plus pounds, and you got to put on a lot of weight to, you know, play basketball. And when we got back, the compliance office at the school called us and said that they were concerned that the NCAA wouldn't believe that he ate as much food as he did at the Outback. And so they sent a bill to my parents and, you know, made us pay this bill back. And, you know, it's pretty insane when you consider what's going on here when he goes to his college and, you know, he's playing in front of 14,000 plus paying, you know, ticketed customers every night on national TV, all sorts of marketing stuff going on.
Well, and now you're working with student athletes in an advocacy capacity, and some of the students actually live on food stamps.
Yeah, so when I was in college, I have a lot of friends, you know, throughout all my playing years at different universities. School's much higher profile than the one I played at. And when the cafeteria shuts down during winter break or whatever, and you're still on campus, you know, the schools are putting kids on food stamps. You know, these are players who have really high, if you look at the economics of it, really high market values. So you're essentially, through all these restrictions, turning potential makers into takers. And that's taxpayer money going to that. And it just doesn't really make sense. And a lot of the programs also rely on, you know, federally funded Pell Grants as a way for these players to get by. When I was in school, me and my brother wanted to start a charity concert series. I can't have my name anywhere near it because I, as a college athlete, you're sacrificing your name, image, and likeness 100% to the NCAA. So we're doing this concert. I can't sell sponsorships. I can't get reimbursed for anything I do. There's just all these ridiculous rules, and I just never really understood why. So I discovered an organization back then that was a nonprofit player advocacy group called the National Collegiate Players Association. Mm-hmm. And I started doing research for them. And we developed, you know, a student athlete bill of rights. We were doing everything we can. This is for years and years and years now. Currently, really the only way to change anything for the NCAA is through the courtrooms or through, you know, intense political pressure and legislation. It's not a very fast moving prospect. And if you just see from the day that Northwestern, you know, unionized or tried to unionize, the amount of changes that took place from then till now are, you know, drastic. It's been a drastic difference. And so I think that players need to see that and realize that it needs to go even further.
So to give us some sense of perspective, I mean, you couldn't use your own name or likeness for, you know, financial gain for a charity. But what kind of money are college sports organizations making off of these players?
It's a multi-billion dollar industry, especially when you look at the high revenue generating sports of football and basketball. Third-party companies are making tons of money. You know, mm-hmm. March Madness alone has a $1 billion TV deal with CBS. Like that, it's an insane amount of money. So the money basically goes to everyone but the players. For example, my coach, when I was at UMass, left the summer that I was going into my senior year to sign a $3 million contract at another university, and he had a $10 million buyout on that. This is a lot of money. That's life-changing money. But yeah, it's going to robust athletic department staffs, like a lot of staff, different coaches, facilities are, you know, getting really out of hand. But it's, you know, it's kind of the nature of the sports world. To your fans, you need to look like you're doing everything you can to win. So you need to spend all that money. So most of these universities are going to say, like, hey, we're losing money on sports. But are you really, and is it really just a spending problem that you have? You know, does your school really need a new $30 million, you know, basketball facility? Or could it be, you know, a $10 million facility and $20 million to help with, you know, workers' comp and provide insurance and, you know, do exit visits with a doctor for your football players and cover regular checkups every 5 years to, you know, monitor their brain and everything?
What does it take to be a Division I athlete? Well, Luke Bonner is with us. He wrote about his experience for Vice. It takes a lot of work. There are a lot of rules, and there's a lot of fear of losing your standing and very little in the way of protection or rights for student athletes. Now, there's a lot of fear here on the part of the players to complain about this. You know, you worried about if you were criticizing the system, it would reflect badly on your team or your coaches. Your parents had two other kids coming up in the side of the system and, you know, didn't want to complain about paying that Outback Steakhouse bill. Players in general seem too afraid to speak up. Do you think they have rights that they may not be aware of, or are those rights just not extended to them?
I mean, sadly, there's really no legitimate outlet for them to have any rights. Until there's a legitimate players association, there isn't. It's only through, you know, like I said, the courtrooms or political pressure. That being said, you have a voice. As an athlete, you're the product and the labor driving this multi-billion dollar industry. And you have a lot more power than you realize. And it's really hard to understand the power structure at play unless you've been in it. And the promise of, you know, every college basketball player thinks they're going to make the NBA and make $1 million. So why would you put that at risk? Reality is you're not. Like, a few of you are. And this is, a time of, like, your most relevance, I guess. And you can learn a lot by, like, you know, doing business and figuring out how to, you know, to operate some of these things.
Well, last summer, this did go to court. The National Labor Relations Board did overturn a decision to allow football players to unionize at Northwestern. You know high school athletes and potential college athletes. Would that realistically diminish the drive of any student athlete? I mean, is anyone going to say, no, you know, I'm not going to take the athletic scholarship. I don't have enough rights.
No, you can't, because there's no alternative. Take me, for example. When I was in sixth grade, I was a 6 foot tall kid, you know, size 17 shoe. My brother and sister were already being recruited by, you know, every coach in the country. We'd be at the Concord YMCA, and Roy Williams and Mike Krzyzewski and Billy Donovan would be there on a daily basis.
I don't know who they are.
But the prospect of, you know, getting seen by these coaches, you need to travel in the summer. You need to go to tournaments and All-American camps, and it's expensive. And, you know, my family couldn't really afford that for three kids. So my parents had a very real conversation with me at, you know, 12 years old. If you want to pursue, you know, basketball, it's an expensive hobby. And, like, if you're going to go to college, like, this is your chance to go to college and pay for that. Mm-hmm. So at 12 years old, you know, I'm already, like, thinking about how am I going to go to college? And basketball was the route for me. Mm. Obviously, it helps that I'm 7 feet tall. When people who meet this with a level of apathy, you know, will say, if it's so bad, why don't you go to, you know, Europe or China or go to the NBA and make all the money you want? But I think we can do better than, you know, if you don't like it, leave our country.
Well, you brought up a couple things. You brought up economics for one thing. You really have to, you know, be in the comfortable middle class, it sounds like, to be on a travel team anyway. And there's also a racial dimension. At the University of Missouri, the football players showed how much power they had when dozens of African Americans on their team threatened not to play unless the president resigned. Now, this was in response to a number of Black Lives Matter or associated protests at the school. He resigned. Now, why did it work there at the University of Missouri, yet other players feel like they have no power?
Honestly, I think my perception is money. If they don't play a game over a weekend, there's a lot of money involved in what they're doing. And they're the most visible, you know, faces on the campus at that time. So for them to stand up really, to me, illustrated the power of these players if they are to come together in some sort of organized manner.
So what would it take for the NCAA to organize similarly?
That's a great question. It's going to take former players speaking out and realizing it's okay to talk about your experience in an honest manner. Even what I've written, I don't think there's anything remarkable about it. And the second I posted that, you have to understand how much power these universities have over you. When that thing got published, I was literally sitting in the corner of my office, like, shaking, scared how this is going to...
You mean your article advice? I wondered about that.
Scared how this is going to be received. Am I going to be just completely alienated from my alma mater? And I'm not complaining about, like, anything that crazy. The reality is the response is overwhelming. My department that I studied invited me to talk to the students there. I even had, you know, past associate athletic directors reach out, like, it's really well thought out, like, supporting me. Because a lot of stuff is really common sense and just, like, you know, common decency even when you're talking about the amount of money involved in these sports. So I think it's really just empowering these players to educate them on what's kind of going on around them and just making them understand that they have power. Sadly, with the Missouri stuff even, they tried to draft state legislation after that. That would give, you know, the university the power to strip players of their scholarships if they were to boycott. And that ended up getting a lot of huge, you know, mm-hmm. blowback and didn't happen. But if you look at how the university leadership talks now, even there's stuff being said that's really dangerous in terms of that and about how they demand that their student athletes be socially responsible and they need to show up to practice in games or else run the risk of losing their scholarship. And some might argue how those players acted, you know, that was incredibly socially responsible.
Your brother Matt, he went through this, you know. Now he's an NBA player. You know, I've seen the videos. He lives with all the trappings. He's got a great house, a great career, great wife. You know, all the things that he might have dreamed of as a high school or middle school player. Would he say it's worth it?
Yeah. I mean, it's the only way that as kids we could see that you would, you know, be able to go to college. And all the cliche stuff you hear about being on a sports team, they ring true, yes. But you look at my family, we are absolutely the poster of NCAA success. Bring us to the convention, which they moved to D.C. so they could lobby from Indianapolis recently. We are NCAA poster success, and my entire family, just 100%, there needs to be a players association. So I think if that doesn't illustrate what's really happening behind the curtain, then nothing does.
Well, Luke Bonner, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Luke Bonner, he's a sports and entertainment marketer for GYK Antler. We were talking today about his article for Vice magazine, which created quite a stir. It's called What I Paid to Be a Division I Athlete. We have a link for you to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Ryan Family Amusements is a bowling alley in downtown Falmouth, Massachusetts that opens at 9 o'clock on Wednesday mornings, which is not quite early enough. That's the day senior league bowlers start crowding the door at 8:30, all ready for their weekly games. They come for the competition and the company. Nancy Klinginer brings us the story of one woman who's been playing longer than anyone else.
Walking into the Candlepin Bowling Alley in downtown Falmouth, it's kind of like walking into a time capsule. Seriously, this place could be from the 1960s or 70s. In fact, the machines that set up the pins are from the 60s. But time goes on here like anywhere else. Ask Nellie Kenyon. She just had a birthday.
94.
Congratulations.
Too many, a big number.
You look great.
Thank you.
Nellie does look great. If you met her, you'd probably think she was 20 years younger than she is. She's really well put together, too, neat and tailored. She wears nice earrings and coordinated outfits. Nellie's the veteran of the senior league. They bowl every Wednesday morning in the off-season, from Labor Day to Memorial Day.
How's it going today, Nellie?
So-so.
Yeah, what does that mean?
I'm going along with my average, which is not very good. When I started, I used to be around a 92. Now I'm a 78 average. I got a hip that needs replacement for the third time. And I'm too old to have it done, period. I refuse to have another surgery at this age. I'm just too old. But anyway, I'm here, and I'm the last survivor. This league, when I started here, 35 years ago, these 12 lanes were filled, and we had six on some teams.
Today, they're only using half the lanes, and most teams have just three people.
And I'm the last survivor. There's not one person left that was in that league except me.
This bowling alley is managed by Ryan Family Amusements, and it's all Candlepin. Candlepin bowling is a New England thing. You use a smaller ball than regular bowling. It's about the size of a bocce ball. The pins are smaller, lighter, and straight. You throw three times instead of twice. And the pins you knock over stay in the lane. They call that playing the deadwood. When Nellie approaches the lane, she stands upright and squares herself off. She doesn't hesitate before she throws the ball. Sometimes she leaves her arm extended long after the ball is gone, like she's willing it where to go. Other times, she puts her hands on her hips, like she's exasperated. She keeps watch as the ball goes down the lane. Which, to be honest, takes a little while with Nellie's ball. She doesn't throw as fast as she used to. She still pays close attention to the scores. Her own score, her teammates, her opponents. And she gets all excited when her teammate Ralph bowls a terrific game, 140. That's about 50 points higher than he usually bowls these days. Nellie has kept on bowling even as she's cut back on other things she loves, like golf. But she's not sure how much longer she can do it.
I think this is my last year. I don't think I'm coming back next year. on account of the hip.
Nellie's only been bowling candlepin for 35 years, but she's been bowling a lot longer than that. She bowled growing up in Bridgewater. In the 1950s, she was a young mom. Her husband died of a heart attack at 40. She was left with three kids. The oldest was 7. The youngest was 3 months old.
And the girls, you know, felt sorry for me, my friend, my neighbors. And so they would come down every day, and we'd go walking with our babies. And they got me to go bowling.
Nellie supported her family waitressing and selling real estate. In the 1970s, she married again. She and her second husband, Charlie, moved to Falmouth in 1979.
Everybody was going home. So we took a walk down the beach that night, and we ran into this other couple. And I says, "What do you do now here?" She says, "Well, we're starting bowling tomorrow."
Nellie and Charlie showed up the next day and started bowling twice a week. They bowled together for 13 years until Charlie died. That was 22 years ago. But Nellie stayed with the senior league and Wednesday morning bowling. Being the league's veteran means she's lost a lot of friends along the way. Earlier this season, Nellie's teammate Barbara started losing weight, and she was a slim woman to begin with. Barbara went to Boston for a checkup and was diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. She stopped coming to bowling on Wednesday mornings. Nellie tried, but couldn't reach her on the phone.
And I finally sent her a card, and I wrote on it, "I wish you'd come and visit with us. I says, we miss you. I says, come and at least, you know, visit with us," I says, "because you've been a part of us for so many years." And she wrote me a letter, and I'll let you read it. I'll never part with that letter. "Dear Nellie, thank you for your thoughtful card and note. It's nice to know that my bowling buddies care. There is no cure for ALS, and I have accepted my situation. I am now under the care of hospice and will most likely only be at home for a few more days. I am at peace with God and my family. At these last stages of my disease, I only want to be with family. Keep bowling as long as you can. Nellie, Ralph, and Barbara were a great team, and I miss the sport and most especially the people." Wasn't that a lovely note?
Yeah.
Breaks my heart. It really does. Because she's bowled with us for years. And she bowled 5 weeks before she died.
It's another Wednesday morning. So, of course, Nellie's back at the bowling alley.
"Janet, are you going to bowl with us steady next year?"
But this week, she's talking about what will happen in the fall when the league starts up again.
"I had a cortisone shot, you know. That's why I do feel better."
So it looks like you're going to keep on bowling, huh?
"Well, it's a long way to September. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But if I feel like this, I will bowl because I really enjoy it."
Nellie's taking her friend Barbara's advice to keep bowling as long as she can. In Falmouth, Massachusetts, I'm Nancy Klingener.
Thanks so much for your listening time today, and there is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. Also, don't forget to visit our social media pages. We're on Twitter at Word of Mouth and on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio, where we're asking you to weigh in. Have you ever considered leaving the country because your candidate did not win an election? Or more likely, if somebody else's did? Well, when did you think about it, and where did you think you'd go? Let us know on our Facebook page. We'd all love to hear it. And things are much more fun when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.